The new brain trusters were image men, historians, and writers, propagandists in the most benign sense, concerned with spinning words and pictures. Kennedy was no dunce, but he understood that in the modern age, style tends to trump substance. An indisputably handsome and charming man, he obviously benefited from the rise of television, and the Kennedy machine represented nothing if not the triumph of style in American politics. Kennedy's political fortune also stemmed from the fact that he seemed to be riding the waves of history. Once again, the forces of progressivism had been returned to power after a period of peace and prosperity. And despite the unprecedented wealth and leisure of the post-war years, indeed, largely because of them, there was a palpable desire among the ambitious, the upwardly mobile, the intellectuals, and above all, the activists of the progressive liberal establishment to get America moving again. More than anything else, the conservative publisher Henry Luce wrote in 1960, the people of America are asking for a clear sense of national purpose. This was the dawn of the third fascist moment in American life, which would unfurl throughout the 1960s and into the 1970s, both in the streets and universities, as seen in the previous chapter, and in the halls of government. What ended as bloodshed in the streets began in many respects as a well-intentioned revolution from above by heirs to the Wilson-FDR legacy, incapable of containing the demons they unleashed. Perhaps the best expression for this bipartisan elite clamor for social change came in a series of essays on the national purpose, co-published by the New York Times and Life magazine. Adlai Stevenson wrote that Americans needed to transcend the mystique of privacy and turn away from the supermarket temple. Charles F. Darlington, a leading corporate executive and former State Department official, explained that America needed to recapture the collective spirit of national purpose it had enjoyed during parts of the administrations of Woodrow Wilson and the two Roosevelts. You can guess which parts. Above all, a reborn America needed to stop seeing itself as a nation of individuals. Once again, collective action was the cure. Darlington's call for a decreased emphasis on private enterprise amounted to a revival of the corporatism and war socialism of the Wilson and Roosevelt administrations. On the eve of JFK's inauguration in January 1960, a Look report, utilizing data from a special Gallup survey, found that Americans were actually feeling pretty good. Most Americans today are relaxed, unadventurous, comfortably satisfied with their way of life, and blandly optimistic about the future. The trick, then, was to rip Americans' attention away from their TV dinners and fan-tailed cars and get them to follow the siren song of intellectuals. And that meant Kennedy needed a crisis to bind the public mind to a new Sorrelian myth. Great crises produce great men, Kennedy proclaimed in Profiles in Courage, and his entire presidency would be dedicated to the creation of crises commensurate with the greatness he yearned to achieve.